I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
Leinster could have me 5 mil a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Tommy Moe!
Robbie Weekly.
Little reverse pass. Oh!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to your Monday episode of Rugby Weekly Extra. I hope everybody had a really good Easter weekend. It's Gavin Casey with you here, and I'm joined by Bernard Jackman to look back over a mixed weekend for the Irish provinces in the URC, and we'll chat about what was a disappointing day, ultimately, for Ireland in the Women's Six Nations as well. But firstly, Birch, how was your weekend?
Yeah, great. Back from Florida Friday morning into the RDS on Friday night for, I thought it was a great game. Obviously, it was one-sided in the end, but I thought the scoreline didn't reflect what a contest it was for a long period between the Bulls and Leinster. And then down to Tolmond on Saturday night to watch Munster and Cardiff, which was painful enough, to be honest. Pretty poor Munster performance, but they got the win, I suppose. And Sunday off, and yeah. Happy to be back in full rugby Champions Cup week, so it's a good week.
It really is. Yeah, I'm sure we'll be looking ahead to those games kind of organically as we go as well. Let's start with Leinster and the Bulls. It was a top of the table game, and certainly in the first half it was a game that lived up to its billing. Personally, I felt it was a game that lived up to its billing in general, even though Leinster ran away with it. There were just so many massive moments in it. Talk me through what you thought of Leinster's performance to begin with, because ultimately it's a victory, 7-1, is it, in the end, and it is comprehensive. Did it feel that comprehensive to you overall? Like, was the scoreline just?
No, well, the first half, Gav, when the Bulls were milking scrum penalties, you feared for Leinster a little bit, and you know, at 12-11, when Aronson scores a try, you know, they've shown a little bit of quality in terms of counter-attack. Leinster kicked long and they ran from deep. Willie LaRue, you know, we know how dangerous he is, and Aronson is a quality player. But then after that, I thought, you always feared when you looked at Leinster's bench and how strong they were, and you looked at the Bulls' bench and it wasn't the same quality that Leinster would pull away. I thought Leinster were, you know, people talk about Leinster's blitz defence, and obviously it's been a big change in terms of how they defend. But what was most impressive, and even speaking to Jake White Saturday morning, it blew me away how good their scramble was. So basically, the Bulls made, I think, 4 or 5 line breaks. And normally after a line break, it normally takes 3 phases to get kind of set in an optimum defensive organisation again. And you know, the next phase, you have them under pressure. Sometimes you get a penalty, sometimes you get another strong carry just because they're not set. And Leinster, within one phase, were back set perfectly. And I think that blew me away, and it blew the Bulls away in terms of, like, how do you break this team down? And that's something that wasn't always the case. Look, they scored 7 tries. But under Lancaster, they probably would have scored 7 tries as well. But it's their ability to make teams work incredibly hard to score, I think, has improved dramatically. And like, they'd be fired up with Aaron's try, because on the kick chase, Van der Fleer allows himself to get blocked by a returning attacking player. He just goes the wrong side of him, and then they're cut open. And look, we know, you know, the Bulls, any of the South African teams from deep, they've got a good amount of pace. But in general, I thought their phase defence and their set piece defence was really good. And it was a nice game for them to come back, get all their international players back together, and get a really good win, and sets them up nicely. I think Leo now, when he looks at who he sends to South Africa, I think he's going to be pretty comfortable that they will finish top now. Whereas if he had lost that game, he may have had to send a stronger team than he would have liked to South Africa.
Yeah, there's every chance that for the third time in a row, we won't get to see a full-strength Stormers Leinster, kind of a battle in Cape Town, which would be a pity, but Leinster have earned that right now. Just on the Aronson try, I don't think we necessarily have to spend a great deal of time on this, but Luke McGrath's challenge, the yellow card, I know you were on comms for the game, but in Ireland, we didn't have you. So what were your thoughts to anybody who missed them at the time?
I heard Quinny, who's a good pal of mine, Quinny thought Aronson was at fault, which interesting take, to be fair. Look, I've got lots wrong as well. I'm of the opinion that Luke should have got red there. To be fair, I couldn't see any real mitigating factors. I mean, I also would put no blame on the ball carrier. I mean, he's going to protect himself when he sees someone coming across at that speed. I didn't think he raised his elbow or anything like that. So for me, it's Luke's unbelievably brave, but you're liable to get a red if you come flying into contact as recklessly as that. And I'm surprised there's been no sighting. To be honest, I think that's one of the ones that we just need to be pretty hard on. I have seen over the last couple of weeks, there's been probably a reticence to actually use red cards. It seems TMOs and referees are looking for excuses. And I understand in the Six Nations when you have a bunker where you just defer that decision to an outside team who have time. But I think that's a red. I think it's a red. And if you're the Bulls, you feel hard done by. You know, I think if that happens to an Irish player in South Africa, Irish fans are up in arms, you know, saying it was a hometown decision. And I look at neither the TMO or the referee were hometown, but I just think that's a strange one. I also think that the try that was ruled out later on in the game for Aronson kicking Ross Byrne on the ground, I think if that's not a try, that's not even a penalty. You know what I mean? I think that Ross milked it. There's a slight contact. The ball is on the ground to be kicked. You know what I mean? It's just one of those rugby incidents. But that wouldn't have changed the course of the game. Leinster were by far the better team. But I just think in terms of consistency, a couple of things, like there's been a bit of controversy at the moment around, you know, obviously Austin Healey. The TMO last week was basically picked up on comms saying that he didn't want to look at something because Austin Healey had flagged it. And unfortunately, obviously, like theoretically, the TMO shouldn't hear the commentator. But the reality is, they're in a small truck. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in a truck, and it's not soundproof. And I actually don't really see an issue, and I'm open to debate on this, but I don't see an issue if the TMO does hear a co-com or a commentator or someone in the truck point out an act of foul play. I mean, does it really matter if it is foul play? You know, I don't know. I know some people say you should be totally biased. That's one thing I want to throw out there. The other thing is, but Harlequin's bat, Ernie Herbst was sin-binned. Harlequin's had ran into a massive lead and Bat started to come back and he came back on the pitch after 7 minutes. Like, you know, the fourth official couldn't even get the 10 minutes right. You know what I mean? And again, does it really matter if does it matter how we get to the right decision or how we get to the right application of the laws as long as we get there? You know what I mean? So that could have actually, Bat were coming back. Herbst came back on when Harlequins had another man in the bin and certainly made some impacts on the game that potentially saved Harlequins from and helped them win it. So yeah, that's just my look. I don't know what the right answer is. Obviously, you don't have too much outside influence, but I'd be more of the opinion that as long as we're getting the right decisions, probably doesn't really matter what the process is. But maybe I'm wrong.
It is an interesting one. I think with the Saracens Harlequins one that you mentioned, where Austin Healey was inadvertently involved, obviously the refereeing body came out and apologized for what they described as a kind of an unfortunate situation. And I don't know, are these the right words? But to be fair to the TMO, Stuart Turhege, isn't it, in that incident, he had already reviewed the footage that Healey had raised, but it was the fact that then Healey had raised it, he didn't want to go back and look at it. Like, it may have looked kind of worse, and then all people are like, ooh, that should be checked. He felt that there wasn't enough in it when he had initially reviewed it, and then if he was to go back to it, it looks like, well, the commentator has basically determined a little match outcome. So look, he may have gotten his initial decision to not make a recommendation based on the original review wrong, but there's an extent to which I see where he's coming from then in not going back to it just because it's been raised. It was a messy one, and as you say, it's not as though these officials are watching a game with a match feed that we're watching with like commentary. It's just a little bit of bleed over every now and then because the truck is so small, and that was one of those unfortunate incidents. You know, on the Bulls feeling aggrieved as well, Bert, I guess one way I would always look at a game like this is there's no point afterwards in pissing and moaning. And to be fair, I don't think the Bulls have so
they
much.
No, they didn't.
But, like, you're playing your rivals at the top of the table. If you want to be a better team or be known to be a better team than them, you want to beat them 15 on 15 anyway. You know what I mean? You can make the point that what McGrath does there is actually ill-discipline and it's a mistake that should have warranted like further punishment on the scoreboard over the course of the second half, say. But ultimately, with 15 against 15,
So myself and Leo and Jake went for coffee on Saturday morning, and there wasn't anything from the Bulls given out about it. Like, to be fair, I'm just making a comment. And like I said, I Luke McGrath isn't a dirty player. It's just, it's very unusual for a Leinster player to actually have an incident like that. Like, their discipline is normally so good around head-high contacts, you know, and as all the Irish teams are generally way more disciplined than their counterparts at international level and club level, it just stood out for me as an incident when I went, ooh, is that not red? You know what I mean? That's all. And look, there's no malice in it. It's just a really clumsy, reckless challenge. But the Bulls were really interesting. I mean, Jake... it was interesting. I listened back to Jake's post match and you know, some of the for the South African press and you know, saying, oh, what can you learn from this game that's going to help you next week against Leon? He was like, there's nothing in this game that we can fix in a week. It's very much where we want to be as a franchise, to be able to have. So his argument, or his not his argument, his reasoning is that effectively, the Bulls players, and he has some internationals, but he doesn't have a huge amount of current Springboks. They're learning in the Bulls environment. They're learning in the URC. They're learning in the Champions Cup next week. Whereas the vast majority of that Leinster team were learning at the World Cup and the Six Nations, and that's just the reality. And he said the Bulls that would have been in Super Rugby at the very start, the Bulls franchise that were winning Super Rugby titles, kind of had that, you know, Dan Sheen, Rowan Keller, you know, depth, you know what I mean? In nearly all positions, you know, so they'd Victor Matfield, Backy's Bota, but then they had, you know, two other Springboks to come on. And at the moment, even though they've recruited extensively with the likes of Wicko Lowe coming back from Harlequins, Marcel Coetzee coming back from Ulster, Kanan Moody coming through to their academy, you know, phenomenal talent. But realistically, I do agree with them that they're not at that level yet. And Leinster's 20 years in the making, really. I mean, obviously, it's longer than that, but I suppose Cheka came in 2005, and, you know, I was looking to be part of that. Like, since then, there's been a massive push towards professionalisation at all levels, and I think now, whatever, 19 years later, you're seeing a team that's kind of set up, you know, for success, and the Bulls are trying to get to that level. So he wasn't... And it's not an excuse, and people sometimes don't like head coaches, director of rugby's, you saying that, but that is effectively the reality. If Leinster are on their game this year, and I know they got caught the last 2 years, and La Rochelle will have something to say about it, and others, but if Leinster are on their game, they should be incredibly hard to beat.
I guess one of the things that the Bulls could take away from that game, if they were to apply it to Leon, was just how bad their kicking was, actually, Birch. And it was interesting to see the extent to which they made those errors, but also I would say the extent to which Leinster looked blistering in transition, which is probably something we associate with them traditionally, but maybe we hadn't seen a huge amount of this season. You wouldn't have described Leinster's season so far as like scintillating to watch, but it became that much in the second half, didn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And that's what really blew me away, is how economical Leinster were. And how quickly they could score, you know, in terms of phase count. And I thought they looked really sharp, really lively, able to identify space quickly and exploit it. And then once they get in behind the Bulls, they were pretty ruthless. I thought Rob Russell was exceptionally good. I know he's been really good, but thought that was another step up for him. And he tidied up a lot of poor kicks and ran them back and just looked a real threat. Apparently he's the quickest guy in Leinster squad, and he looks it. And you know, I know they've got Jimmy O'Brien and Hugo obviously to come back in, and that'll mean, and Jimmy O'Brien not immediately, but in time, that'll mean Jordan can move back to the wing. So, and obviously with James Lowe, there's no guarantee Rob Russell's going to get Champion Cup starts, but he stepped up. Jamie Osborne looked really good. Jack Conan was exceptional, I thought. And Van der Fleer's hitting a bit of form as well. But yeah, Leinster would be delighted with how smooth their attack looked. And then again, to be able to defend very well, and then as soon as you get an opportunity, whether it's off turnover or whether it's off counter-attack, to go and hurt teams. It hasn't all been joined up, to be fair, I don't think, over the last couple of years. And they look in a much better place now, obviously. Yet to be seen, but I think they do look like they're better equipped to win battles rather than just win games by 40 points.
Are we starting to see what all of the talk was about in relation to Harry Byrne, to your mind?
Yeah, I thought he was really good. I thought he was really, really good. Like, I still think Ross will start this week against Leicester, but I think Harry's got a huge amount of talent. He looked really confident, comfortable, for a good variety in his game. And that was, for me, I trust people who coach him, who rate him, you know what I mean? And there has been obviously little glimpses of what he can bring. But I thought that was probably the day I left the RDS kind of going, oh, that's what they all see, you know what I mean? In terms of whatever, he played 55, 60 minutes. I thought it was a very nice performance. I still blows me away how Leinster have the next four tens in Ireland are Leinster, you know what I mean? And it's a tricky one to manage. But he's still quite a young man, you know what I mean, really. I know he's just and if he can just stay fit, I think his upside is very high.
That's kind of the thing, isn't it? Because we have seen Harry Byrne have some really good performances this season. You think to La Rochelle away straight away, but you also think he came off injured in that game, and this was one where he left the field of his own volition almost, and
totally
just job completed against a good physical team at that as well. What makes you think though that Ross Byrne will start at the weekend? Is it because you had coffee with Leo on Saturday morning?
No. Leo wouldn't give that away. Leo gives it anyway. Leo's very smart. He just listens, which maybe I should do a bit more of. But I just think Ross is so good at implementing a plan. I'm not saying Harry isn't, but I think he's still number one as far as I'm concerned. I think he'll be given, there's a lot of pressure on to get the job done on Saturday night against Leicester, and I don't think Leicester will mess around in terms of selection or take any chances, you know what I mean? And Harry's done what he can do and did it really well, and will get game time, I'd imagine, but I think Ross will start.
Leinster should absolutely win this game. Leicester are coming in off the back of a never-ending game away to Newcastle Falcons in their own right, mentally, which is insane. Like, is there any case to be made for the Tigers making this a difficult day at the office, or are we just paying them niceties and saying that?
Yeah, I think that's all. Realistically, I can't really hype them up, and believe it. Now, obviously, Leinster underperform, but I don't think Leicester weren't great. They were average enough against Newcastle. Mad game, went over 100 minutes. You know, we're hanging on for dear life at the end, and that's not the kind of form, you know, that's needed to go away to Dublin and to Aviva and beat Leinster typically. So, I'd be more worried or hope. Look, I'd be more excited about what could happen the week after. If it's La Rochelle come to Dublin, to be honest, I think that's a proper match, and you can hype up La Rochelle without any fear without any fear of being called out. Whereas with Leicester, I just think you're just talking up for sake of it. I don't see how Leinster will slip up.
That Munster Cardiff game, you mentioned it was a poor enough Munster performance. It was a second half that needed somebody to seize the game, from Munster's perspective at least. And Jack Rowley did that, I guess, and won player of the match. Mm. And it was one of the few moments of legitimate quality in that game. I'm wondering why you felt Munster were so under par. What you made of the game in general?
Oh, well, just the man of the match. I mean, so Donal was back and forth on the comms mic to myself and Dunnick pretty much for all the second half, like throwing names out there. I think he was as unsure as we were who could get it. It was very hard to pick. In actual fact, you probably would have picked Ellis Jenkins or someone from Cardiff, who actually had the most influence on the game, but he was gone off. And it was those kind of game. And Jack, I think, with his place kick and his try, And his general endeavour probably was enough, but I don't think he was laughing afterwards saying how he's not sure how he got it. Like, it was just a very poor team performance, and he was probably the best of a bad lot, really. It's so typical of Munster, though, to, like, before the match, Murray did a piece on kind of their attack and their, and in fairness, their stats were ridiculous. Sorry, not ridiculous. The stats were number one in a lot of the key metrics around attack going into the game. And then you looked at them and you would have said, geez, have these lads ever met each other before? You know what I mean? There was just so many errors. But it is very typical of Munster the week before a Champions Cup game to be really poor, and then to basically kind of get a bit of flack all week and circle the wagons and come out and find an extra 25%. And I think Rowntree would be hoping that that is the case. And logically, to be fair, it does seem like a bit of a blip, because their form has been okay recently. You know what I mean? Their form has been decent, like particularly from from both sides of the ball. But like attack-wise, they know what they're about. But their execution and their skill sets and their intensity at the weekend on Saturday night was just way off. Now, give credit to Cardiff. Cardiff obviously have had very few wins, but they have 7 bonus points now, losing bonus points. They have been incredibly sticky, and they do make you work for it, and they take the sting out of the game every time there's a break in play, there's someone down injured, and it's very hard to get flow against them. Good kicking game with De Beer. And yeah, they made Munster work, but I don't know, it was kind of a lifeless, the atmosphere was shit. But I can, like, it's not the crowd's fault, because the team didn't really give them enough to get behind, but it was just one of those games where you kind of think, are Munster's heads completely on the Heineken Cup or the Champions Cup? And hopefully that's the case.
It was another example as well, Bert, of Munster just struggling in the power game, wasn't it?
Yeah,
missing Klein.
When you look at their front five, okay, Tadhg Byrne, obviously, Tom Ahern and Tadhg Byrne are like, they're obviously really good athletes, but yeah, their front row don't have any bang, really. I know, like, Scannell has had a couple of big performances this year, but like Toulon away and stuff like that. But realistically, they were actually getting met and matched on the gain line. And there's just no real go forward. Nankivell went off with a little knock. He obviously has been someone who gives them go forward. But yeah, they looked like they didn't have any power, enough power. And that's scary when you think, but Cardiff aren't a powerful side per se. I said they're very dogged, and that's a challenge. That's a challenge, and obviously you bring RG gives you a huge amount of that, and then once you have one or two fellas who can get you over the gain line, even the lads who aren't as big and strong can do okay. It's just when you're looking for someone to get you that momentum, and I think RG is absolutely massive for them. And like, I know apparently he was only sick, and hopefully he was only sick, because I really think they definitely need his spark this weekend.
Yeah, they're facing a team in Franklin's Gardens who just put 41 points on Saracens. So as well as the Northampton sides beating Munster at Thomond Park earlier in the Champions Cup, they're coming in a reasonably good vein of form themselves. Like, that's the Saris team who put 52 the week before on Harlequin, so that was no mean feat. And you saw in that game, Finn Smith probably sticking his hand up again, Birch, as the guy potentially for England a little bit further down the line. He probably outplayed Owen Farrell on the day, which is not to make any grandiose statement about it, just 80 minutes worth. And if you were sitting there in England, in Northamptonshire, you'd be looking at this Munster game and thinking, we've already done them away. We've just put 41 on Saris. Like, how can they possibly stop us? And yet, if you're sitting here in Ireland thinking of that game, you're thinking, Munster just underperformed the week before a Champions Cup game. They'll have revenge in their nostrils going over there. Like, it's a brilliant European tie, and probably both sides have reason to believe that they'll go and win it.
Yeah, if it wasn't Munster, you would you'd be feeling a lot better about yourself, being Northampton, having obviously come off the back of a great win against Saracens, having beaten them away from home with 14 men. But it's Munster, and year after year, good teams, bad teams, and different teams, they have found extra in that in this competition. And do you know what? In some ways, it's a great thing. In other ways, it's actually frustrating. You know, to see a Munster team who over the last number of years haven't been as consistent as they probably should be, you know, have these highs but also have a lot of mediocre performance and lows. Now, this team obviously last year, after the opening difficulties at the start, you know, they did show some consistency in obviously going all the way and winning away from home, quarterfinal, semi-final, final in the URC, which is, you know, credit to them. But yeah, on recent form, and when you look at the quality and look at current internationals like Alex of Alex Mitchell and Finn Smith, obviously isn't a season international, but it really looks like he's on the up. Some of their outside backs, Courtney Laws last season, you know, packed Franklin Gardens. You would say Northampton should be 10-point favourites, but I think it'll be a lot closer than that. And in actual fact, I think Munster could potentially pull a Toulon-like win out of the bag and get through.
Yeah, it's an interesting one in the sense that, like, you can make the Toulon parallel. I actually would say this is up there with one of Munster's steepest away tasks in recent years. Like, typically, if they're going to Gloucester or somewhere, some random Premiership team with the greatest respect to them, you kind of think, yeah, Munster on their day, if they show up, they should have a chance here. Like, I think the Saints are a little bit better than that. Like, I actually think it's a proper backs of the wall kind of a job, which isn't to say that Munster can't do it, obviously. There were more disappointing days over the weekend, Birch, for Ulster in South Africa and Connacht in Treviso as well. We might start there because, Christ, it really looked as though they dug that one out on what was a proper scrap with Benetton, only for Alessandro Isacor to have other ideas at the death. And first things first, I think we should pay credit to Benetton here, Birch, just for the way they actually found a way to win that game. Like, you think after the missed drop goal, it's gone from them, they build again, and it's an unbelievable try. Gutting for Connacht, obviously. I don't know what you can kind of glean from that game. Like, it was kind of built up as nearly a must win for Connacht. Mathematically, it's not. And maybe there's enough in the performance, in the diligence, where you think losing bonus point, fucking go again.
Yeah. I think, first of all, there was a big reaction, obviously, from what was a shocking performance against the Lions. And they looked like they were going to get a win. Like, the defence for that last try was like ridiculously bad. I mean, I don't know what Tiernan Halloran was doing, biting in, you know what I mean? And leaving that space on the outside. But that's kind of where they're at the moment. You know, there's an opportunity there. Benetton haven't come back from the Six Nations as good in any way near the form they were in. Obviously, had lost the week before. And there wasn't really a massive reaction from Benetton. I know they found a way to win in the end, but you would have expected Benetton to be much better, you know, given it was a must-win game for them as well. And so Connacht kind of ran into a team who were a little bit out of shape, out of sorts, and had the chance to win it with a minute to go and then, you know, blew it. So I think, obviously, point to point, they didn't hemorrhage points like they did the week before. So maybe got a bit of respect back. But, like, the reality was there was three more points there for the taking. And they needed to get them. I worry now for Connacht for this top eight. I know it's very close. But I think their last game of the regular season is away to Leinster. They kind of need to be nearly picture perfect in the next few games. And obviously it'd be interesting to see what happens Friday night against Poe in the Challenge Cup. Do they now target that, try and get silverware there, which could give them a massive lift, you know, in terms of new fans and all that stuff and excitement and confidence. But it's just it's not really happening for them to the level I think Wilkins would want at the moment.
I think, look, that is probably the issue in terms of the fixture list. Is you've Leinster away, Munster away as well, and Stormers at home, and Stormers at that point you'd imagine will be looking for at least a home quarterfinal. So that's where the Benetton game felt so important. I tried to dress it up as maybe there being a silver lining there. You're kind of just saying, though, it was pretty shit in the end, like, as in...
I think so, yeah. I think when you look at the match, you know, Connacht were good seeing there was a reaction, but I don't think... I think there was the win was there. The minimum was the win, you know, when Benetton didn't really fire. And, yeah, they're just kind of treading water a little bit at the moment.
Obviously, maybe you could put some of Connacht's lethargy or some of their errors down to, like... It's hard to say this because, like you say, their centre partnership wasn't really like at fault for the winning try at the end. But I guess just like it did feel like a bit of a makeshift Connacht team, Birch.
It did. And I would be, look, I said it last night against the Head. I think one of the things Humphreys needs to look at is player availability. You know, so if Bundy had been available to Connacht or Finney Beelam, potentially that was enough to get over the line. And I know Bundy's played a huge amount, but I'm not sure whether Connacht had the choice and whether they want to play him against Poe this weekend or I'm not. But like I just think there's been a couple of league games there where actually having their internationals would have got them the wins. And at the end of the season, I think if Connacht miss out on the Champions Cup, it'll be part of that. And likewise, if, you know, there was early on in the year, Munster weren't allowed to play Pete and Connor, you know, for a couple of important games. I just think it needs to be looked at by Humphreys next year, and it shouldn't be black and white. The provincial coaches should be given a little bit more say in it. And I know it's all about Team Ireland, and Ireland are back-to-back Six Nations and all that, but realistically, we also just need to have an eye on what the provinces need as well. And the URC is getting tighter, is getting stronger. So maybe what worked 3 years ago and meant that everybody could get into Champions Cup anyway, maybe that won't work now or next year. So we just need to look at it.
Say if the situation arises that Aki is back and Finlay Beelam is back against Poe, what chances would you give Connacht then?
Well, it depends on where Poe's head are at. I think if Poe are on, that's an incredibly difficult game for them. Poe are a good side now, but Poe may sound stupid because it's a Challenge Cup, whatever, last 16. And you know, the average fan would think, oh, of course they're going to go for it. But honestly, in France, particularly tough for particularly for clubs like Pau, where you know most years they start off with an objective to stay up, top 14 is absolutely king, and they have a chance of making Champions Cup next year in its own right. They're having a decent season, and they may decide to prioritise that. So if Poe heads are on, I can't see Connacht winning this week.
Yeah, Poe are only 3 points behind Bordeaux, sitting in seventh at the moment. They're going nicely, all right. Just to chat about Ulsterbridge, I guess it feels similar in a way, in the sense that if we didn't quite get the Ulster reaction we were looking for last week in Durban, you definitely got it in Cape Town. It just ends in disappointment again. How did you feel they went?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. See, I thought it was better than Sharks. I thought it was better, and I guess a better side as well. I think Richie would be really happy. I heard his interview afterwards. He's very proud of his players, and you know, the game got away from him a little bit. In fairness, the Stormers, I think, they basically went back to plan A and just used power and set piece to get back in the game. It was kind of a disjointed performance by the Stormers. The Stormers are quite a tricky team in that they can be bang average for 70 minutes, make a load of errors, but then just something sticks, a little grubber kick through, bounces up the right way, and next thing they're away. They've got a lot of kind of X factor and dynamism, but they make a huge amount of errors, and it was kind of looked like it was one of those days where they were going to just be error strewn. I thought their kicking game was horrendous. And in fairness, Ulster's defence was one of the better defensive performances for a long time from Ulster. But then it's just the end, yeah, it's just that power, that bench, and yeah, an opportunity gone to have a famous win in Cape Town. But at least they looked like they were a bit more together, a bit more resilient. And when you look at some of their performance early on in the year, that wasn't the case, and that probably cost Dan McFarland his job. So I think Richie Murphy would come back, obviously thinking that they've turned a corner and hoping that there's a bit of a run now.
We got a glimpse into the future as far as the out-half shirt is concerned. Nathan Doak starting there for just the second time, I think. He started one Christmas against Connacht in Galway in 2022. I have a feeling there might have been one more. Murray reckons it was only two. I'll defer to him. How did you feel he went? And like, is this a transition that you can see actually working longer term? Obviously, you have to give him time. But like, is it one that you'd be kind of a little bit more comfortable with going into next season after watching that performance versus a similar conversation last week?
Look, He looked okay. I think like we have to be prepared to give him lots of time. Look, we know he has big match temperament. We know he has confidence and self-belief. And they are like great foundation rocks for any out-half. Obviously, goal kick if he's needed. Obviously, they don't need to have Cooney. But if Cooney's not playing, he can goal kick. But I think he needs a lot of time in the jersey. I mean, it's not like in France where they grew up playing 9-10 and interchanging. You know, he's been a 9. And I don't feel it's fair on him or fair on Ulster, I've said this before, for them to start the season. And look, I've no evidence that this is the case. If they do think they can start the season with Flannery and Doak as their only 10s, and Larry is a backup, I would say that's very, very risky, to be fair. But again, you know, there's a rumour now that Kitchoff might want to go back to the Stormers. That would open up a non-Irish qualified spot. That would open up a lot of budget. And I think having a ready-to-go 10 is more important to Ulster now over the next 2 years, while Doak develops into a 10, if that's what they want to do. Or Flannery develops into a top class 10, than having a loose head prop who, you know, is still playing international rugby, and you have the risk, injury risk, you have the fatigue risk, etc. And I'll give you a name that I'd love to see AJ McGinty come back to Irish rugby. You know what I mean? And I don't know how long it is since he played for America, so I'm not saying that he'll eventually re-qualify for Ireland, but he would be someone that Ulster could. He's a foreign player, obviously, technically, but knows the Irish system well, really smart. And you know, if you get a Kiwi or an Aussie, there's the whole how long will it take them to kind of come to terms with the Northern Hemisphere rugby, etc., etc. Whereas someone like AJ McGinty, you know, you could actually build a team around him for a while. And also, I believe he's very smart off the field and very smart on the field in terms of during the week. So yeah, it's just someone I thought about the other day when I thought about who Ulster could go after. And he would be someone who'd be amazing for them, I think.
Yeah, he would be one of those ones you could see just being that veteran coming in. Like, McGinty's, what, 34 now, probably? He's 10 years older than Flannery, 12 years older than Doak. He'd just be a great presence to have around the place as much as anything, wouldn't he? Like, it's a good shout. Is that that's just something you've concocted on your own? No whispers?
Yeah, totally. No rumour. No. Just my wish list. No, I'd be trying to think what tens are available, who could do that job of helping develop, you know, who aren't selfish enough that they don't see the big picture, which potentially is to bring through two young tens. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he just kept in mind. I mean, I've always rated him. Obviously, was 10 for Connacht when they were under Pat Lamb. Then he went to Sale Sharks, and now he's still you know, one of the most probably highest rated tens in England. Had a few injuries, to be fair, but yeah, someone like him for me might be worth a look.
I had a question here from Phil from Lisburn. This is about Johnny Petrie's departure from Ulster. He said, "It feels kind of unprecedented that the RFU would basically step in like this. Is the financial situation at Ulster really that bad compared to the likes of the other provinces? I get that everything is relative, but it seems a bit odd to a layperson. It seems like recruitment has been our biggest issue, both from a coaching and player standpoint. And yet Teflon Brin seems to be secure in his role, despite some of our bigger signings. Vermeulen stands out in particular recently, having not had the desired impact. Was there something in particular that led to Petrie getting the shove, like the Kingspan situation, for instance? It's hard to imagine a Leinster or Munster CEO getting the heave-ho under similar circumstances."
Yeah, this is, we haven't been told how bad Ulster's financial situation is, but certainly there's been big pressure on the coaches to shave some money off the wage bill over the last season or two, and apparently for next year. And you know, that led to 5 or 6 players being told in January that they wouldn't be contracted, some high profile players, and it certainly wouldn't have helped the dressing room morale, because sometimes players don't care who's real, it's just who delivers it. So that seems to be the case, that there is a financial squeeze on. Now, is that because they've overspent, or is it because they've under-earned, you know? So, you know, have sponsorship deals not been as lucrative as they projected? Has ticket sales not been, and corporate hospitality not been as fruitful as they would have liked? I'm not sure. The problem is, I think, a little bit with the recruitment side of things, there is certainly a rumour or a feeling that John had more of an influence than most CEOs in recruitment. You know, obviously he's an ex-rugby player, I think when he was working in Scottish rugby, he did have his hands on a little bit. So I don't know if this is true or not, but certainly the rumour was that he was very much hands on in recruitment, which Mick Dawson, for example, wouldn't be. They're very much aware of it, but they don't say, "Oh, I think he's a better player than him," or whatever, right? So that may be part of the reason. Look, Brin and David Humphries are obviously very close. So you would see, as soon as David Humphries got the job, I think there was always a strong chance that Brin was going to get more powerful rather than get weaker. And if that means that the CEO moves on, I'm not sure. Look, I don't know if the RFU did it, the board did it, but unfortunately for John, his time has come to an end. And to answer the question, I think he probably had his fingerprints over some of the recruitment, apparently. And maybe that's what got him in the end, you know?
Yeah. It is one of those situations that kind of remains unclear. You're just trying to piece it together from the outside for the moment, aren't you, Birch? And
yeah,
I'm sure more information on it will come out over the next few months, particularly where player releases are confirmed, etc. It'll become evident, I think, on that.
You could also have a situation where, and again, I don't know, I'm just talking like what happens in sporting situations like this is potentially if the board, you know, kind of felt a while ago that maybe Dan McFarland, for example, wasn't the right man, and Petrie insisted he was, well then when he eventually had to go, you know, you're damaged by that as well. Like, there's so many different things that that could be at the heart of this. It might be one, it might be a little bit of lots of things that eventually just the scales tip the other way.
Richie Murphy will be seeking his first victory in the Challenge Cup away to Montpellier. How do you see that one going?
I think there's a chance. I mean, Montpellier are very much preoccupied with top 14 survival. Obviously, had a horrendous start to season, axed Richard Cockerell, got some good results, not immediately, but you know, recently got themselves out of a bit of trouble, but then lost at home at the weekend to the Stade. They lost at home, so lose a bit of momentum there. But Aynar, after going on a bit of a free fall, so I think Montpellier 1,000,000% will be concentrating on top 14. So this is a big chance for Richie, and again, Ulster, a run in the Challenge Cup, win the Challenge Cup, will be massive for him and them.
Yeah, they've been really hot and cold, Montpellier, haven't they? As you say, lost 10-12 to Stade at home at the weekend. I mean, cold actually, because they shipped 50-odd away to Toulon, was it, the weekend before?
But before that, they've been getting a few results. They won away in Oyonnax.
Yes.
They got themselves
out. That was
a thriller, yeah. They got themselves out of a hole. They were then buried. Then buried in October, but I think they have, when you look at their team, they can survive for sure. Next year they could be a top 16, but I think for now Challenge Cup will be very, very low on their wish list.
Ireland's bid to secure a top 3 finish in automatic World Cup qualification to begin with in this Six Nations Championship took a serious blow at the weekend, Birch, at the RDS against Italy, and they finished with the kind of, I don't know, guttural response and the kind of attempted comeback where, if you're a fan, you're walking away probably not you're gutted, obviously, but you can at least kind of see, all right, there's still hope here, right? But it was a pretty poor performance, I thought. Just in terms of the skill execution, in terms of just making such basic errors, good players making these errors as well, that ultimately costs them. And you're 0-2. It's just tough. I find it tough to see the silver lining in this one, to be honest. I don't know about you.
Yeah. No, there's very little. I mean, it was a very poor game. Obviously as an event, my daughter went to it and she really enjoyed it with some friends, and, you know, there was a decent atmosphere and all that stuff. But and they're growing and they're developing. But if you actually, it depends how you want to look at it. Do you want to look at the 80 minutes and what actually happened on the pitch? I think if you look at that, it's very poor. It's not good rugby as such. You know, there's loads of endeavour, loads of intent, but some of the errors were really poor. But I suppose to take the optimistic look at it, you know, they finished really strong. They won the territory in possession. There's an obvious signs of how they want to attack. Just obviously their passing quality on the day wasn't good enough to take advantage of that. You know, the emergence of Wafer, you know, she looks to be outstanding. You know, I thought some of O'Brien's kicks were excellent. But in general, I think the biggest weakness they have is their kicking game is so poor. Like, it makes it very hard to control games. The games are kind of... And look, they're not the only one. Not Italy's kicking game was pretty average as well. So basically, there's no real flow or pattern to the match. It just goes one way or the other way. You know what I mean? Because no one can really... I know Ireland dominated territory, but it's not... you couldn't guarantee you'd do it next week. You know what I mean? Because there's no real rhythm to it. It brings me back to it. Like, someone asked me, "Oh, what can the coaches do to fix those errors?" Like, you look at that coaching staff. That's an expensive coaching staff. You know, Scott Beaman's flying in from England. You know, John McKee went to the World Cup at Fiji twice in the men's. You know, he's a consultant. Declan Danaher's been signed from London Irish as defence coach. Dennis Fogarty's a consultant scrum coach. To be a plethora of physios and S&C and all the things that teams need, they're supporting them. But it brings me back to, you know, I said it before about Eddie Jones and the coaching conference, where he went for about 8 hours about tactical periodization and Mourinho and Guardiola. And at the end, an Italian fella asked him, he said, "Oh, Eddie, what's the one piece of advice you'd give me us young coaches if we want to be successful?" And he said, "Get good players, mate." You know what I mean? And like, that's it. Like, the reality is they have the shapes. But until those players develop into good players, and look, the argument is, coaches make them good players, but in what time frame? You know what I mean? Like, the reality is, the players that Leo Cullen gets, or Graham Rowntree gets, or Pete Wilkins gets, or Richie Murphy gets at under 20s level for Richie and now Ulster, they've had 7 or 8 years of training and coaching and competition, that has helped develop them. Whereas these girls, unfortunately, that's not there. Like, there's walkovers in the AIL this year because the teams can't field. You know what I mean? So that's the reality of it. So, and I think the great thing is, if you listen to these players and the ex-players, etc., there's no complaints about the environment anymore. There's no complaints about the RFU's support, which is it should be a given. But and it's nonsensical that we have to praise him for that, but we should praise him for it, because it's a case now that there doesn't seem to be any bad feeling towards the RFU. But now we just need to be really patient, and again, no one likes to be patient, but the reality is, we need good players, and the only way we're going to get good players is through time, good coaching, which I think they're getting at international level now. But how can we improve that all the way down to the club game, to the underage, to the youth? How can we more girls playing rugby? All that stuff. And that's the challenge. And obviously we're starting very late to this, because this hasn't happened, and that's what's left us where we are. And I think a win would give these girls a huge amount of confidence, and that will obviously hopefully help them be less stressed and play a little bit better, because I don't think the skill set is as bad as we saw at the weekend, but it's not where it needs to be. And, you know, Scotland, I think, look, there's two divisions. I mean, Italy, Scotland, Wales and Ireland are probably not far off each other, and then obviously France and England are miles ahead. But it's got to be patient now, and hopefully that they can get a couple of wins. See, the WXV3 competition in Dubai, it was great. You know, they beat Spain in 15-13. But, like, playing Kazakhstan and Colombia, like, you learn nothing in those games. You know what I mean? So that's the challenge, is to try and start beating the teams that they're kind of competing with on a more regular basis, and build a bit of confidence. But, yeah, it's going to be a long road.
Yeah, maybe a more scenic road towards the World Cup might actually be no harm, just based on getting that more competitive big game experience into young legs. And
I think the WXV3, obviously, you know, Kazakhstan, Colombia, that's a waste of time. But teams like Spain, etc., you know, where you win those tight games, get into a battle, have to actually, I suppose, implement a game plan, maybe adapt a little bit on the hoof, you know, that'll be good for them. Playing England and France, too often actually can be more damaging than it helps.
Can be. We'll leave it there for now, Birch. Thanks a million. Great to see you.
All right. You too, buddy.
Thanks, everyone at home as well. We will catch you later in the week. Well, today's Tuesday, so we will catch you tomorrow. And mind yourselves in the meantime.
But the boys in a better land. You're always talking about the boys in a better land. The boys in a better land. Drivers got names for 50 double barrels.